The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and a Happy New Year to you all. One of the most significant developments in the world of philanthropy from this past year was the introduction of Philanthropy Cloud from Salesforce.org. And I will be joined this evening by their Chief Executive Officer, Rob Acker, who explains how these new tools will change how we look at our giving.
When you look at giving, it is a very personal thing, but we also want to be connected up to our common humanity. And the fact that you can start to see, like, what personal impact am I making towards this goal? Mm-hmm. How does it roll up to the Sustainable Development Goals? And how are we making progress as humanity? It starts to kind of, it will connect us all. It will make us feel like we're all part of something bigger.
And then I will be joined by Ron Cordes, the co-founder of the Cordes Foundation. He was a pioneer in impact investing, of which he says this.
One of my favorite quotes is that the longest journey in the world is the 12 inches between your head and your heart. And I think that impact investing is really investing along that spectrum.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, January 6. Brian Armstrong, the 35-year-old co-founder and CEO of cryptocurrency trading app Coinbase, has joined the Giving Pledge, bringing to 185 the number of those pledging to dedicate the majority of their wealth to philanthropic causes. Armstrong has a net worth estimated to be $1.8 billion. A social worker who was known for his thriftiness, he would patch his shoes with duct tape, left most of an estate totaling $11 million to children's charities in Washington State. Alan Naiman, who died of cancer in January 2018 at the age of 63, was unmarried and childless and had worked for the past two decades at the Department of Social and Health Services, handling after-hour calls and earning less than $70,000 a year. Jeff Bezos is bringing in a familiar face to run the education arm of his new $2 billion philanthropic initiative. Michael George, the ex-Amazon vice president who oversaw some of the company's most successful products such as Alexa, will lead the Day One Academies fund, Bezos announced this past week. Men are overrepresented in online image search results across most occupations, a report from the Pew Research Center finds. And finally, there were over 750 million people living below the international poverty line across China in 1990. By 2015, the number of Chinese people living in extreme poverty had plunged to just 700,000. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Rob Acker, the CEO of Salesforce.org, right after this.
Before you give to charity, go to CharityNavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. CharityNavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving.
Do you remember your first job? We all deserve opportunity, but the frustrating truth is that while talent is equally distributed in the U.S., opportunity is not. 6 million talented young adults in the U.S. are out of work and out of school. Year Up empowers these young adults with valuable skills and connects them to leading U.S. companies. The results are real. 85% of Year Up alums are employed or in school within 4 months of graduating. Support opportunity for all young adults. Visit yearup.org. Follow the Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to the Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
Because of technology, much of what we do and how we do it has changed dramatically over the past decade. Facebook for socialization, Amazon for shopping, Netflix providing entertainment, and Google retrieving that information we want or need. But beyond being able to give online, not so much in the world of philanthropy has changed. But that may be changing with the introduction of Philanthropy Cloud by Salesforce. And here to tell us about it is Rob Acker, the Chief Executive Officer of Salesforce.org. Good evening, Rob, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you, Denver. It's an honor to be here.
So tell us a little bit about Salesforce.org and what the mission of the organization is.
Well, the simplest answer is that we were started in 1999 as the foundation. In 2013, we changed to Salesforce.org. And our mission is to improve the state of the world. And we do it in three ways, with technology, as well as investment, which you might call grants. And then the third way is also community, which is we get involved and our employees involved in the community and give back time back into the community.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we get into all that, one of the things that I've always admired about Salesforce is your ability to look at the broader context of what's happening in society and only then create initiatives and products that fit into that landscape. So let's touch upon several of those larger issues first, Rob, if we may. And let's begin with trust. You know, the Edelman Trust Meter indicates that trust is really at historic lows. People have just really lost faith in our bedrock institutions. Speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, I find it ironic. It's really interesting. I think that this is one of the greatest times in human history to be alive. If you look at many measures or in many measures of how we measure progress, it's extraordinary. Like, for instance, extreme poverty. If you were born in 1820, 94% of the world's population lived in extreme poverty. Today, it's just 8%, which means it was a high degree of likelihood you were going to be born into extreme poverty, no matter what your race was, what country you were born in. And so the thing is, but if you look at basic education, literacy, child mortality, vaccination, we have made remarkable progress. Yet at the same time, like, none of us feel that way. We feel very anxious. And the question is why? And that Edelman Trust Barometer, trust in media, trust in government, trust in nonprofits, as well as business. United States fell 37 points last year. This is extraordinary dichotomy of things kind of going on that are completely opposed.
Why do you think we feel so stressed, so anxious? I mean, I know your friends and colleagues and mine as well, everybody is on edge. Something is missing. They're worried about something. What's at the heart of that?
So that's a great question. My theory about it is that we live in a connected world. And so there's a number of things that are happening. The same thing that's driving all that progress is that we're connected. And now we're more than ever connected. Everybody's got a mobile phone. Mm-hmm. We can see things and we're informed about things. So like I sometimes use this as an example, but Malala, you know, if you were born in 1820, going back to that date that I just referenced, you would have never heard of Malala.
That's
but
right.
Now we do. And it's in your home and it's in your living room. So that's a positive. But it's also creating anxiety. The fact that we're hyper-informed anytime there's a horrible incident, a school shooting, when you know, something bad happens in the Ukraine, a bus gets bombed in Yemen, Syria, an earthquake, a hurricane, natural disaster, they hit our phones.
Instantaneously.
Right away. And so you see that and you're like left – people are left wondering, what can I do about that? And the other thing, too, is that we've also seen technology, too, because on a somewhat related note, being used in ways that we don't like.
Mm-hmm.
We see it being used to promote hatred, to divide us, and, you know, even to influence elections. We saw what happened in Kenya during the elections, but we also sound familiar. We saw what happened in our election. And then I also think that there's a third thing going on. There's a rapid pace of change. Some mm-hmm. people call it the fourth industrial revolution. And things are changing fast. And people are anxious because jobs are getting replaced and displaced, et cetera.
Yeah. And to your last point, there's a lack of civility. 84% of people said that they've experienced incivility. And the average is about 10.6 times a week. And much of that, as you know, is happening online, whether it be the fake news that you just talked about or people just feeling safe, I think, behind their computer that they'll just go right after you if you don't share their opinion. It's a serious issue.
It's a big issue. It's actually something that I think about every day. I think about it in the work that I do. I think about it personally. I think about it in raising children. We need to find a way to align around a common set of values and figure out a way where we can respect differences of opinion. And this country was built as a melting pot.
Mm-hmm.
This country was built on diversity. And we talk about diversity and inclusion in the workplace. We talk about it everywhere we go. Yet, for some reason, we're not tolerating diversity of opinions just about everywhere. I do think that there's a role that businesses, technology, et cetera, can play. I'm trying to figure out what that role is. I'm trying to learn as I go about how we can restore trust, how we can restore civility.
Well, tell us what you've learned so far, because you are one of the most optimistic people that I've ever run into. And you really do believe that technology can help bridges the divide. Give us a few thoughts you have on that.
Well, I think being an optimist requires discipline, especially in this time. But I very much am, and here's why. I mentioned the fact that we live in this connected world. We all have mobile phones. We all have these devices, and we're connected. The great majority of people, I work with people on all sides of the spectrum, the political spectrum. We're working with nonprofits, social change agents, and there's people. And what I find is that they might sit on opposite sides of the equation, but they all want to do the right thing and do good. They're not tied to the media narrative where we're being divided. They're trying to figure out ways to connect us and work together across boundaries. So what better way than to use technology, since we're already connected with technology, but to actually allow people to organize, scale, drive, measure, and predict impact with that technology? And the funny thing is contrary to what we might be seeing in the media, when I meet people, these people and leaders on both sides, they genuinely really want to work together. And I think we can take technology and go that last mile and start to connect people up to impact.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people want to go from that news feed where they feel anxious to action.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to be able to take action, and they also want to be able to find common kindred spirits who are willing to go solve those problems.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it sounds to me what you're trying to do is sort of remove some of the friction that exists. Because getting back to my opening, we were talking about Amazon and Netflix and things of that sort. People can do that instantaneously. And I had Josh Wright on the show the other day. He's the executive director of Ideas 42, and his specializes in behavioral science for social good. And he talked about how we have these great intentions. Let's say you're filling out a financial aid form for your child, but then you run into that piece of information that you just don't have. So you put it aside, and you get back to it 6 weeks later after the deadline has passed. I think a lot of that happens in social good. We see something, we want to do something, but it's not as easy as hitting a one click on Amazon. And that is something which you're doing around this philanthropy cloud. Tell us a little bit about how that will work.
Yeah, so the idea came is, it's actually a fairly long story. I'm going to try and keep it brief, but many years ago when I first came into what was then the Salesforce Foundation, I moved over from Salesforce in 2013. We had 60 employees, but but there was a really interesting phenomenon going on. People wanted businesses to get more engaged, and we were getting hit on every issue from every angle and asked to get involved. And I didn't want to let people down. I wanted to be able to serve and these people. But they're just with 60 people. How am I going to be able to respond? But we were a great bridger and connector between a number of different issues. So going back to then figuring out, like, there's got to be a role for technology. I mean, if I can go on Amazon, who sells 540 million unique, distinct products in the United States, and I can find what I'm looking for, there's got to be a way to
and have it on your front door in the next day or two.
Right. Exactly. And, if there's 17 sustainable development goals, there's got to be a way to, like, line up around these causes. So if we could put these kind of social issues and go from that news feed, whether it's a natural disaster, whether it's an environmental issue, and line people up at an individual level to be able to kind of figure out, go as far as they want to go and impact, whether it's giving money, volunteering time and matching up volunteering opportunities, or going deeper, actually a layer deeper to get involved in substantive policy issues. If you could do that for every individual and then track that back to our global progress against the sustainable development goals, big idea, but it can't be that hard to do.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a customized way. Well, why don't you walk us through the Philanthropy Cloud experience? What do I need to do to set it up? And then what will it provide for me?
So the idea is that, first of all, we are primarily distributing it right now to companies and organizations. There's a big movement. Michael Moeller, the Director General of the UN, introduced me to the Sustainable Development Goals. And I thought, well, if we can map back every, social issue that's going on to a Sustainable Development Goal or every cause, companies are being pressured to measure their footprint, not only by the global, body that exists, but also by individuals. Millennials have changed the game.
Yeah. Investors.
Investors, too.
Yeah.
And there's a big movement on that. And so what if we can measure a company's progress against the global goals, that's a good starting point. So, and I think so. We distribute it back, directly to companies, but there's a big, solid individual use case within that. So if I am a company and I want to have a branded cause that my company cares deeply about, ocean cleanup, let's say, for instance. But I'm an individual who might be second generation Syrian. I might care about the Syrian refugee crisis. You might have a branded site for my company or for the company I work for that's ocean cleanup. But I might be interested in saying, like, okay, I live in Buffalo, New York. I'm a second generation Syrian. I'm interested in the Syrian refugee crisis and what's going on there. I can find what I'm looking for. I can map myself back to volunteer opportunities, giving opportunities, maybe even go more deeply into the substantive issues or the policy making issues. And it starts to intelligently pick up who I am, where I live. The interesting thing for an individual is that if I leave that company and I go to another company, it will take my individual giving record with me.
Oh, that's cool.
But my footprint will be left behind.
Mm-hmm.
So both win in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
So the fastest way to do it that we're doing it right now is we're trying to distribute through corporations first, and then we're going to figure out how to go directly to the individuals.
And as you begin to fill out this profile and decide what you're interested in and get these news feeds, you have something called Einstein. Tell us about Einstein.
Well, I inferred this a little bit, but Einstein will pick up, you know, your interest areas, your demographics, you know, based on, let's say, for instance, I use that example, Buffalo, New York. It'll pick up and say, okay, here is what you are interested in. Here's what generally captures your attention. It'll see what you're watching in terms of what you click on, etc., and it'll start to intelligently match you to things that might be most relevant to you based on your geography, based on your interest areas. And so that rather than, as I said, if you were shopping on Amazon, 540 million unique distinct products, you can find what you're looking for. Well, that experience should be exactly the same way when you're going after philanthropy. You don't have time to sort through every single cause and issue and then all the organizations around it. So it's trying to intelligently map back the most relevant opportunities to you.
Yeah, sort of one-stop shopping. So
the
way it is right now, if I read an article, I care about it, then I have to go and find an organization that is doing something about it and go on to Google and get to that organization. And when you take all those steps and you can have them all together integrated, it makes all the difference in the world. It does remove the friction.
That's right. And the goal is exactly that, to remove the friction. And you know, I think the thing is that if you go online and you're trying to find something and it takes you more than a few minutes, we are all like very short attention span people. So it's got to be a quick, easy, very simple to use experience for the individual, but also to deploy.
Yeah, I remember the old AOL days when you get the 5 hours and you get the whirly thing going around and we spend all our time waiting. Now we wait a nanosecond and we've moved on to something else. You talked about that you're distributing this to companies right now.
Yes.
And a key partner of yours from the very outset was the United Way. I mean, their CEO, Brian Gallagher, on the show a couple months ago. Why were they the perfect fit for Salesforce and what has their contribution been to this effort?
So it's a really funny story. So initially when we started looking at this idea about, it's almost 2.5 years ago, I had Brian Gallagher and a number of people out in the office from United Way. And I said, what do you think of this idea? And they're like, we need to. We were talking about working with them as a technology partner just to distribute our software to them. And they're like, well, we should work on this together. And so then Brian and I started working really closely. We talked to Mark Benioff. The other thing, too, is that we are a public benefit corp, but we're a nonprofit. So I can't go raise money to go build such an amazing platform from the outside world. So dawned on us, like, we're the world's number one CRM vendor. United Way has over 100 years, basically, corporate giving experience. Why not take what you do best, United Way? Why not take what we do best, and let's co-invest, and let's make this thing really work?
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, Rob. You know, there are a lot of people out there who really care and want to help others. They can have a difficult time finding a cause that they feel really passionate about. Philanthropy Cloud help in this regard?
Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
There's a number. You can search by causes. You can sift through content. You can search by causes. It's very much the best way I would put it is it is very much like going on to Amazon and shopping. And we want to have an engaged experience, one that you kind of look at different issues and study issues and start to learn about the issues, have rich content that really attracts you so you can browse through it. You don't have to always have the end result be that you're going to give money or find a volunteering opportunity, or more about how do I study an issue and how do I find interesting content that informs me of these issues out of this divisive narrative that we have today.
Mm-hmm.
That is really trying to take you down a path of understanding the issue in a highly objective way. And what that'll do is that'll start to pull in people and it'll start to give people hope.
Mm.
Because I think right now the current media narrative, I feel anxious too, because the media narrative is highly divided because that's what sells.
That's right.
And the thing is that is pulling a lot of people away. That's creating a lot of anxiety, a lot of hopelessness. And that's why that dichotomy that we talked about in the beginning, why I feel optimistic, because the stats are showing that it's amazing. When you go from 98.4% of the world's population being in extreme poverty to 8%, the The challenge is we're not reflecting on that progress we've made. We're hyper-focused on the 8%. So then that's a great thing, though, to be hyper-focused on the 8%. But let's not make that a negative thing. Let's ask ourselves, how do we supercharge that and take capacity of people who want to be engaged, want to understand the issues, make it interesting so that they actually engage and we can go fix that 8%. And they feel hopeful, not hopeless again.
Yeah. And you're not being a Pollyanna here. What does is it
Maybe.
Puts things in context, though. I mean, we've lost context. We never look at the course of human history. We're just looking at the moment and what we're being fed. Now, Rob, Philanthropy Cloud integrates into two of your other platforms. One of those is Nonprofit Cloud, and the other is Education Cloud. Tell us about those.
Yeah, so one of the extraordinary things about being the number one CRM vendor, connected to the number one CRM vendor in the world, and the fact that we live in this connected world, is given us an extraordinary opportunity to actually connect those two up, drive incredible impact. I would argue our greatest area of impact is through technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea behind the Nonprofit Cloud, which we launched this year, is that because everybody's connected, nonprofits can connect with their constituents, their donors, advocates in ways we never previously imagined, which will drive impact. It will measure impact in ways that we could have never also imagined. And so when you think about that, whether you have 8 people in your organization or 8,000 people in your organization, you can connect up with hundreds of millions of people. Mm-hmm. In the old days, it was direct mail. It was very manual. You couldn't scale. You can now scale, regardless of the number of people, in ways that are going to change the world and drive more impact. The same thing is true on a little bit different note is also with education. Imagine from the time you are recruited, let's say in higher ed, recruited as a student, to the time you are a student, and what was your student experience like, and then all the way to where you're an alumni, where you are changing the outcomes of education. I'm managing my education over my mobile phone. Not only can I schedule an appointment with an advisor, I might be able to join an intramural group. I might get content published to me in highly personalized ways. You know, let's say I was a poli-sci major. Somebody's coming in, a former speaker of the house is coming in onto campus. Let's target them. Let's create a rich experience for them.
Mm-hmm.
What ends up happening is I end up becoming really connected to my institution. If you're the institution on the other side, you start to have an entire student body and alumni body connected up to the institution as well. And you can start to measure working, what's not working. Why are people dropping off between freshman and sophomore year?
Mm-hmm.
With people in these majors that aren't successful, what majors did they, and there's universities doing that, majors did they, you know, transfer to the, where they had a better come on their career? And what happened to the poli-sci majors? Did they become lawyers? Do they become business people? And these become really interesting statistics that will inform us on working, what's not working in education.
Yeah, that's all very interesting. And, you know, sometimes I think about giving, and it so often is a solitary act, as you were talking to about before, direct mail. You're in your home, you just send a check. But it sounds, the way you speak here, Rob, is that Philanthropy Cloud has a way of connecting you to making you part of something much larger and then seeing what that much larger is accomplishing. And that just absolutely changes your perspective about yourself and about the world and about the issue you're trying to solve.
You know, it's a really interesting point that you just hit the hammer on the nail, because I think the thing is that when you look at giving, it is a very personal thing, but we also want to be connected up to a common, our common humanity. And the fact that you can start to see, like, what personal impact am I making towards this goal?
Mm-hmm.
How does it roll up to the sustainable development goals? And how are we making progress as humanity? It starts to kind of, it will connect us all. It will make us feel like we're all part of something bigger.
Solving something. I mean, when I get a mail, let's say, to help the famine in sub-Saharan Africa, you know, I send in $50. What difference does that make? I mean,
right.
Millions of people. But when I see I'm part of this incredible cohort of millions, collectively we're doing this, I say, we can actually solve this.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And that's why you said earlier, I don't want to sound Pollyanna here, but I really fundamentally do believe this. And I believe it's needed now more than ever,
mm-hmm.
because I do think that we need to restore hope. We need to restore trust, and we need to restore, you know, the focus on what we have in common. Everything that we're talking about today is like, why are we different and how we're different and why our differences are either right or wrong. And like, if we can start to line up around a common enemy, which is whether it's an environmental concern or a common enemy, which is a disaster, or line up, then we can start to stop being common enemies amongst ourselves and then focus on things that are going to help humanity for generations.
Definite game changer. Let's discuss your giving a little bit. And two of the areas that you have particularly invested in are education and mm-hmm. workforce development. Why those two, Rob?
Well, I mentioned it in the beginning, but it starts with, first of all, we started with, when 2013, our grants budget was $8 million.
Mm-hmm.
This year it's going to be $50 million. My goal is to get up to $100 million on an annual basis. The thing is that, you know, that may be a lot of money, but you can't solve every problem in the world with that. So it's about focus. And when we realize what area can we influence the most with focus, focus and with those dollars? It was education and workforce development. Because as a tech company, there's a thing that's going on right now. I referenced it earlier, the fourth industrial revolution. And there's a great risk that large groups of people get left behind as industries shift. There's a lot of anxiety about it. I actually think there's more anxiety than will pan out into reality.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the loom was created, everybody in the textile industry was mortified, thinking that like, oh, the textile industry is dead. But here we are, several hundred years later, and textile industry is alive and well. It's just industries are shifting and new jobs, meaningful jobs are being created. Guess where the biggest shortages are with the most meaningful jobs? In the tech industry.
Yeah.
750,000 jobs in the UK by 2020, a shortage.
Hmm.
High-paying jobs. Meanwhile, other industries are getting phased out. We have similar stats here in the United States. So let's invest in education because, one, it will ensure that people have hope, that we have a diverse, a talented, and empowered, skilled workforce that's prepared for the skill with the skills they need for the 20th century. 21st century. Sorry, wrong century. I'm old. The thing is that let's make sure that they're prepared for that. And I think tech companies have a role in also helping universities and other organizations or some of these workforce development organizations readapt their curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing organization out here and by the way, in New York is doing just this. Coalition for Queens.
Yeah, they're fantastic. Back in September, you held 4 days of inspiration and giving back out in the Bay Area. It was called Dreamforce 18. Tell us about it. Tell us what goes on there.
Well, so Dreamforce is the largest technology conference in the world, and it is a mix. What's beautiful about Mark Benioff, and this is why I've stated—
That is your CEO.
He is
of Salesforce.
CEO of Salesforce.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is amazing about Mark Benioff is he exposes people not only to the world's leading technology, but also thought leaders, and as well as nonprofits, businesses. And it's literally like a connection point. And I think until you actually go to it, to a number of CEOs who were just blown away by the opportunities that presented there, you have well over 100,000 people there, all connected and looking at the possibilities of technology, but also the possibilities of collaboration and giving back to your kind of multi-sector question. These things all converge and you have thought leaders there. You'll have ex-world leaders there. You'll have nonprofit leaders there speaking. You'll have business leaders speaking. You'll have thought leaders, futurists, and I think it's really an incredible conference to talk about what is. I would say it's as much a technology conference as it is like almost a mini Davos as well.
Yeah, sure.
More of a grassroots Davos where people are trying to align around common messages, figure out how we work together and how we can use technology to work together. It's amazing.
And Dreamforce 19 is already in the works. It's going to be in November next year.
November.
Mm-hmm. Let me close with this, Rob. If you look ahead, let's say 5 years, in addition to what the philanthropy cloud can do, let's see an ease for the individual and for the company, how do you believe it will impact the sector at large? The total amount of money raised, the way we go about solving our problems, that nature.
That's a big, I would hate to put a number on it, but here's what I would like to see.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see over 1 billion people on this, at least within the next 5 years. And that way we, but I would hate to put a number in terms of how much we would raise and by each specific SDG, but 1 billion users, that's what I want in the next 5 years. But I also want it to help change the psychology of the world today from one of anxiety to one that actually can get engaged constructively and feel engaged and not watching or all of this kind of chaos and angst that's going on right now. They feel like there's a platform, something that takes them into constructive engagement. There's more needed than just the philanthropy cloud to do this, but I hope that it does its part in helping make the world a better place.
Well, that is aspirational and audacious, and we need it just about now. Well, Rob Acker, the Chief Executive Officer of Salesforce.org. I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Where can people learn more about Philanthropy Cloud, Education Cloud, Nonprofit Cloud, and all the other things that you do?
www.salesforce.org.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, Rob. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Thanks, Denver.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
A simple smile can say so much. It can say thank you, please, or even I love you. Sometimes a smile can say more than words could ever express. But what if you couldn't smile? Unfortunately, that's the sad reality for so many children today. Without the help of life-saving surgery, helpless children find themselves cast aside and all alone. But it doesn't have to be this way. To learn how you can help Smile Train, the world's largest cleft charity, change the world one smile at a time, go to smiletrain.org.
With nearly one in four New Yorkers struggling to meet their most basic needs, we know our city is facing a crisis. But did you know that our highest poverty rates are among women and mothers? These women don't need handouts. They need a hand up. That's why Grameen America provides tens of thousands of women across our city with the loan capital they need to start their own small businesses. With the gift of entrepreneurship, these women have the opportunity to escape poverty, provide for their children, and gain independence. Join the movement today. Invest in New York City by investing in them. Visit GrameenAmerica.org to learn more. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from the Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
When it comes to second acts that are dedicated to the greater good, it would be difficult to find anyone who has done it much better or had more fun in the process than my next guest. And while many who venture into the world of philanthropy for the first time just go with the flow, he has pushed the envelope from the very start to find better and more creative ways to use capital for social good. He is Ron Cordes, the co-founder of the Cordes Foundation. Good evening, Ron, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thanks, Denver. It's great to be here.
Well, a successful second act usually rests upon a successful first one. So tell us about that and what you did before you started the foundation.
Sure. Well, my first act story is frankly fairly simple. I was the first in my family to get a college degree. I typical graduated on a Friday, went to work on a Monday, and got into the investment business, which was the passion that I had in my 20s and 30s, and was fortunate enough to meet two young peers who ultimately became my business partners. We formed an investment consulting firm called AssetMark in the 1990s that caught a wave in the industry, became successful, and we ended up selling the company in 2006 to a global insurance company. And that led to my wife and I creating our foundation. But backstory, the sale of the business was really driven by a conversation I had with my two partners in 2004. I turned 45, and I just felt like I was ready for something else. The terms first act and second act and encore weren't even really in the lexicon yet, but I just felt like there was something else that I was meant to do, and I felt like I needed to move from what I was doing currently into a new space where I had the time and bandwidth to explore it.
So when you sold that company in 2006 and you decided you wanted to dedicate your time and resources to making a better world, you probably envisioned making grants from a foundation, but that's not exactly what happened. How did you first get introduced to the world of social entrepreneurship and impact investing?
Yeah, so if you'd have asked me 12 years ago, I would have said exactly that. My wife and I were envisioning ourselves being traditional philanthropists because that's kind of the only model that we had known and seen. So I became introduced to social entrepreneurship because I was part of starting a program at a university in California. A dear friend called me up and said, I've got an opportunity to start a social entrepreneurship program at a university in California. And I said, hey, I want to help. I'm all in. I just have two questions. One, where is this university? I'd never been there. And two, what is social entrepreneurship?
Two good questions.
And so this friend, he's become a dear friend since, Jerry Hildebrand, connected me with a book written by David Bornstein, mm-hmm. who I've also come to know over the years, called How to Change the World. And something about social entrepreneurship just clicked with me. I think I'm hardwired to build things. So the entrepreneur in me, that book and beginning to meet then a bunch of social entrepreneurs really started to have me thinking that I'd spent the first half of my career, my first act, building what I hoped would be the best business in the world. Could I focus my second act on helping to build the best businesses for the world?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how I kind of got started down the social entrepreneurship track.
And you have said, Ron, that one of the most important days of your life was November 1st, 2008, when you were in Uganda. What happened that day?
So I'd taken, with this university in California, I'd taken a group of academics and business people to Africa. We were looking at a variety of different projects, some philanthropic and some like this project in Bayubo, Uganda, an impact investment project, a microfinance program that we'd helped create, and we'd made a small capital investment to fund the first 20 loans for the women in this village. And we went and visited them, and they were excited to see us. And we walked down this kind of the street in the village, and each one of the women showed us the businesses that they'd created with their loan. And there was one woman, her name is Florence Maduku, she's remained a friend over all these years, who pulled me aside and had something really important to say. So what she said really kind of crystallized for me. She said, "We appreciate when you, people from the U.S., come to Uganda to save our children, but we need to save our own children.
Mm.
Thank you for investing in us so we can do that." And that kind of hit me like a lightning bolt. For me, November 1st of 08, Mark Twain has this great quote, "The two most important days of your life are the day you're born and the day you find out why." And for me, that why was this kind of crystallization that I'd spent 30 years in the investment world, and I'd really thought that I was leaving that world to go into the world of philanthropy.
Mm-hmm.
And now I was finding that I could still apply a lot of the same skills and experience that I'd had from the investment world, but do it in this super productive and meaningful and powerful way where I could use investment tools in a way to help not only Florence, but hopefully a million other women like her in the developing world.
I don't even recall, Ron, whether impact investing as a term existed at that time. But you, very early on with your foundation, invested 20% of it in these purpose-driven, socially good businesses. How hard was that at the time to do something like that?
It was like the Wild Wild West.
Yeah.
There was no infrastructure that existed. We'd been part of this university program, so we hired a couple of young MBAs.
Lynn University, right?
It was actually Lynn University today. It was originally the University of Pacific in California,
mm-hmm.
because I was based in San Francisco.
And you made the commencement speech there, I saw last year.
I did, yes. Yeah. So we brought in a couple of young MBAs, and we said, get out and give us the universe of everything that's available in this new field of impact investing. And the universe was small, but we did. By August of 2008, we were proud of the fact that we'd invested 20% of our endowment across about a dozen different funds and investments, mostly in the developing world. And then, of course, in September of 2008, the world implodes,
mm-hmm.
right? The financial crisis. And one of the things I was concerned about was I really felt strongly about the impact theme of these investments that we'd made, but how are they going to perform financially here in the worst financial crisis of my lifetime against everything else we had in our portfolio? And wouldn't you know that when everything was marked to market at the end of 2008, that 20% not only wasn't the worst performing, it was actually the best performing in our portfolio. So I'd found from an investment world this kind of uncorrelated investment category. And that really propelled my interest to say there's something here. How is it that I can kind of get in front of this, become an evangelist for this, and maybe help build some infrastructure to help this field move forward?
That's absolutely fascinating. I guess Florence didn't have any derivatives, right?
Well, you know, I joked at the time that it was as if Florence and a million other entrepreneurs around the world just hadn't gotten the memo that there was this global financial crisis.
Yeah.
They had borrowed some money, built businesses, paid the loans back, and were going on with their lives in a very productive way.
Are there any legal standards or thresholds, Ron, to be considered an impact investment, or can any old investment just slap that label on it if it so chooses?
Well, that's a great question. So today, it's probably still more of the latter than the former.
Mm-hmm.
It's by definition. But what's happening is that the industry, and I'm proud of the fact that I've been involved in a number of efforts over the last decade to help this process, the industry is building its own internal standards that investors and advisors are looking to. So there's various organizations that have come about, largely led by an organization called the GIN, the Global Impact Investing Network.
Mm-hmm.
There's a corollary organization called B Labs, which has come out with this B Corp certification.
Right. Both of them have been on the show.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Terrific. And so between them and a few other initiatives, there are now ways for an impact investor to start, when they look at an investment, to start kind of checking some boxes and saying, okay, is this investment aligned with some of these standards so that I know that the concept of impact is more than just a conversation.
Mm-hmm. So they're really trying to put a measurement to that social impact.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there a danger that when you're doing that and you fall in love that your investment and all the good it is doing, that you forget about the financial return?
There is. One of my favorite quotes is that the longest journey in the world is the 12 inches between your head and your heart. And I think that impact investing is really investing along that spectrum.
Hmm.
So, you know, for me on the heart side, it was experiences like with Florence in Bayubo in November of 2008. On the head side, it was clearly seeing the financial results that were meaningful in our portfolio. So, yes, one of the dangers of impact investing is that you have to be rigorous financially. And we have folks coming to us all the time with proposals for quote-unquote investments that really make more sense in the grant side of our portfolio. And we're more than willing to provide some early stage grant capital to help seed ideas that could end up being commercially viable down the road. But it's a difficult conundrum sometimes to separate the two and to say to a social entrepreneur, I love your impact theme and I love the good that you can do in the world with this, but you need to build this further before it's ready for investment capital.
Yeah, a business model would be useful here.
Exactly.
You know, when I think about impact investing, I unfortunately tend to look at it more in a transactional way. That's an investment that's going to have a positive social and environmental impact. But ideally, it's also about the way investing is done and how we think about the purpose of capital. Do you see signs of that beginning to take bloom?
I do. I think that there is a much greater conversation happening today between investors or asset owners and their advisors about connecting their portfolios with their values. So it comes from two sides. One is the transactional nature of I've got X amount to invest and I care about this and how do I do it. The other, though, is the more strategic and important side of determining what are the things that I care about or what are the things that we care about perhaps as a family and how is it that we can use all of our capital. And when I think about capital, I think about philanthropic capital, investment capital, and social capital, right? Would social capital kind of the capital that I'm expending this morning, right, in evangelizing the work that we're doing. So I'm finding that the best advisors out there, those that are the most enlightened in this area, are really starting to work with clients kind of around that continuum of how do you create a legacy for yourself and your family by defining what your values are, and then trying to apply all of your capital toward those values.
Yeah, that's so interesting because that seemed to be the missing piece of the equation for a long time. They were waiting for their clients to say, I'm interested, as opposed to being proactive, saying, you might want to think about this.
Yep.
Because if you can get those intermediaries to be active in this process, it really is a game changer. So when you started this 11, 12 years ago, impact investing, do you think the movement has gone faster than you thought it would be, have gone back then, or perhaps not as fast as you would have liked or expected to have seen?
So I was asked a year ago to give a 10-year retrospective because, as you'd mentioned earlier, it was about 11 years ago that the term impact investing was even coined. It was coined at one of the Rockefeller Foundation retreats, and that kind of helped the industry start to crystallize. And my comment at the time, which I still believe, is that things happen more slowly than you would like them to. So this is a major paradigm shift. I would have expected, candidly, when I got started in this, that if I was being interviewed 10, 12 years later, that the industry would have perhaps moved forward more quickly. But at the same time, as I look back, I'm really proud of all of the work that's been done to get us to this point. And you made a point that is really germane in the space, and that is that all of the surveys that are done today say that the asset owners, the investors, are ahead of their advisors.
Mm-hmm.
A higher percentage of asset owners, 60 to 80% in a recent survey, including millennials and women investors at the top end of that, a much higher percentage of asset owners are interested in pursuing this than their advisors recognize.
Mm-hmm.
And so having come out of the investment business and having some experience and kind of cred with the advisor community, I do spend a lot of my time talking to investment advisors about the fact that if they're not having this conversation with their clients, they're missing something that their clients are interested in talking about. And if it's not with them, it might ultimately be with someone else. So I encourage them to get smart about this, to begin to have conversations, because I think that they'll find that their client base is more interested than they give them credit for.
Yeah, and it just seems to me that this impact investing arc we have seen so many times before. And what happens is it starts with a lot of hype, but it never lives up to the hype, and then it's left for dead. And then actually it begins to reach that reality or that possibility that we had in the first place. And a couple of other examples of that would be internet shopping. I remember people shopping online. It was going to change everything. The department stores are going to close. Nope, people still want to go to the store, touch the stuff, see the stuff. Well, now we see that. That everything is going to be online pretty soon. And the same thing is true for online education. I remember how online education was going to close colleges. And but people want to go to the – but now you see online education beginning. So I think the same thing is happening in impact investing. What kind of role has family foundations played in this? You know, a lot of people tend to look at the big money at foundations and thinking they're going to be leaders in this. But family foundations have really been incredibly active in this impact investing space.
They have. It's been a bit disappointing, honestly, that with about $800 billion of assets today in foundations, foundations in general have not been leaders in this space. Several of the largest foundations, Ford Foundation has made a recent commitment, Gates, MacArthur, some others, have started to commit kind of single-digit percentages of their portfolio. So what I found is I spent a lot of time today talking with other families that have situations similar to ours where they may have been fortunate enough to create a foundation. And what I'm finding is that the leadership is coming from first-generation family foundations where the wealth creators, in this case my wife Marty and I, are in charge of the foundation and are willing to take perhaps more risk, quote unquote, or perhaps willing to be more innovative than a foundation that might be two, three, four, five generations removed from its founder.
Mm-hmm. How would you assess donor advised funds in this regard?
Well, one of the first things that we did in 2010 was we helped to create, we were involved in creating a donor-advised fund platform called Impact Assets, a nonprofit that we created with the Calvert Foundation and some other partners, designed to allow folks that didn't have the resources to create their own family foundation to do this type of impact investing with a philanthropic vehicle. So today, donor-advised funds are a huge vehicle that we're finding are being used more and more, not only for their traditional purpose, which is to allow people to kind of organize their philanthropy in the same way you do in a foundation, but they're also allowing folks to use the endowments of those donor-advised funds to invest for impact in the same way that foundations have been doing.
So let's turn our attention to the Cordes Family Foundation. And if I have this right, your wife, Marty, has a deep commitment to empowering girls and women. Your daughter, Stephanie, who's part of the foundation, is dedicated to ethical fashion, among other things. And you get excited by social entrepreneurs who want to change the world. So let's take that cocktail and mix it all together and tell us some of the investments and grants that the Cordes Foundation is making.
Sure. So when Marty and I started the foundation in 2006, our daughter, Steph, was still in high school. We had long suspected that she would become engaged at some point in her adult life. It happened in quite an interesting way about 5 years ago, and she moved from what had been a career at Condé Nast over to the foundation. And when she moved over, Marty and I had created the foundation around kind of two premises. One was Marty's deep commitment and a lot of philanthropy that we'd been doing privately at that time around women and girls, and particularly the economic empowerment of women, really influenced by books like Half the Sky from Nick Kristof and Cheryl Boudin that talked about the real importance in global economic development of providing economic opportunities for women. So apropos to my experience with Florence in 2008, I looked at my role there as trying to figure out how we could use investment vehicles as a way to provide that economic empowerment and social entrepreneurship. And when Steph joined the foundation, she had had a long interest and had started a career in fashion, and we began to realize that the artisan sector globally is second only to agriculture, is the largest employer of women globally. And so through the fashion industry, looking at this new, relatively new concept of ethical fashion, sustainable fashion, there were actually ways that we could apply our themes of social entrepreneurship and economic empowerment to women around the fashion industry, and Steph has led that effort for us.
Give us a couple of those examples.
Sure. So we're invested today, for example, in a jewelry company based in Kenya called Soko. Soko's jewelry, shopsoko.com, is available both online and in stores like Nordstrom and others. And they work with over 1,000 artisans based in Kenya, many of whom are women, who produce this jewelry, and Soko provides them with the opportunity to connect to a global marketplace. So it's an example of a business that we look for these types of businesses. We've got another one called All Across Africa in Africa that has home goods and baskets. So the idea is
they're in Costco, aren't they?
They are in Costco. Yeah. Yes, they've developed a really unique relationship with Costco.
That's a good place to be, by the way.
It is, particularly they found in the holiday season. So this is a big time for them right now. But what we found a consistency is that you've got these artisans around the world that have over many generations kind of perfected this ability to create something. But yet they don't have a global marketplace with which to sell that. And so they're limited to how much that value creation can drive in their local communities, which often is not very much. Mm-hmm. So the ability to connect them with a global marketplace, whether it's SoCo and Nordstrom, all across Africa and Costco, gives them an ability to produce far more meaningfully quantity than they could have before and to achieve a much higher price point on it. And that combination really drives some economic empowerment.
Fantastic. You know, one of the more interesting and distinctive gatherings in the world of social enterprise is the opportunity collaboration that you orchestrate each fall in Mexico. What makes this different from every other conference that is out there?
Well, it was different by design in its basic construction. We just completed our 10th convening. So it started in 2009. And our original founder brought together a group of people, of which we were a couple, and basically said, what if we created an event that was diametrically different from every other event that was in the philanthropic space? No plenaries, no PowerPoints, no darkened hotel rooms, simply an opportunity to bring the right people together and to facilitate professionally the right dialogues between them. And so we started off on a whim in 2009, wondering if this would be a one-year event, brought together about 300 people from across philanthropy and impact investing. And what we found was that there was an enormous appetite for convening in a different way than anyone had convened previously. And so it's taken on kind of a life of its own. Again, we just completed our 10th year. What we basically do is we rent a 500-room conference property in Cancun, Mexico, for 5 days. We turn it into a college campus. We have the entire property, and we invite folks from across the world. We have about 50 countries represented, and the idea is to bring together the right people who can collectively really make things happen. So we've had investments made, funds started, companies, mergers, nonprofits that have come together. And we're particularly proud of one thing that we did in the second year, which we've continued, is we recognized that there were voices that weren't at that table that should be. Indigenous folks from Africa, Latin America, Asia, who were never on the radar screen of global conferences, couldn't have afforded to have attended. So we created a program we call the Cordis Fellows, where each year we scholarship 60 of them. So the fellowship provides them the opportunity to attend and participate in the event as full delegates. And what's interesting is when we did that, we thought the biggest benefactors would be those 60 folks, and they are. We get these great reports back about how their organizations have been transformed, but we've actually found the other 400 folks really appreciate the opportunity to meet these game-changing, often young, emerging social entrepreneurs who they never would have come across in their daily travels. And that leads to grants and investments and board members and advisors and mentorships that would never have happened otherwise.
Diamonds in the rough. It always works out that way.
Exactly.
Let me ask you a couple of other things. You know, I have a lot of conversations on this show, both on the air and off the air, with founders of organizations, and they're always discussing the decision they had to make as to whether they should become a for-profit social enterprise or a nonprofit organization. And these have been really difficult decisions. What do you believe are some of the factors and decision points that a founder or a startup team should consider?
It's a great question, and it's one that often comes up when we bring our fellows and other emerging social entrepreneurs together. It's funny that when you talk to founders of organizations, they often feel like the grass is always greener on the other side, right? So someone who started as a nonprofit says, gosh, I wish I was a for-profit because there's all this impact investment capital out there that I'm missing out on. Well, organizations that are for-profit come back and say, gosh, it's tough to raise capital, but if I had the ability to raise grant dollars that were non-dilutive, that would be terrific. So my advice is, first off, the grass is not greener on either side.
Good advice.
We are big believers in the concept of social entrepreneurship, which is building a business model that has the ability to generate revenue to solve a problem, but that can be across a nonprofit or for-profit. I think people often get too hung up on the structure. So we've been engaged both all across Africa, and SoCo, for example, are for-profit businesses that have done the typical seed and A-B rounds of financing, where another organization, Fair Trade USA, the Fair Trade certifier for goods and services in the U.S., I just stepped off a great 7-year run as board chair there. We're a $20 million a year organization, 18 million of which is earned revenue, but we're structured as a nonprofit, right? So we're a formidable business with about 110 full-time folks, but we're structured, again, a nonprofit, for-profit. I think that the real key to me is you have to have a business model that both has the potential to succeed financially and the potential to deliver impact. And if you've got that, then you can succeed in either arena.
A hybrid, more or less.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Let me ask you a little about corporate culture, and we always think about that in the context of larger organizations. And I know that you're a family organization, but culture exists everywhere. How would you describe your culture and what makes it special and distinct?
So we're a small organization. We have Marty, Steph, and I, and our portfolio director, and soon-to-be son-in-law, actually, Eric Stevenson. So there are four of us.
We're making news here today.
There are four of us, and we are very much led by the millennial ethos that Steph and Eric bring us. It's funny. In my prior career, I had a business that was very traditional. We didn't have people that work remotely. We had three or four offices around the country. That's just – so when we set up the foundation, we set up an office. And what we began to realize is that the millennial community doesn't necessarily need a place to go in a traditional office.
Yeah.
And so Steph and Eric have really opened us up to this new arena of working remotely, working on their own time frames when things need to be done as opposed to a particular prescribed time frame. And so I think the culture that we've had has really been kind of always focused on our why. How do we have the most impact with our dollars? How do we have the most impact with our social capital? We've created a kind of ethos in the foundation we call the three C's, which is called – we call it connect, convene, catalyze. The idea behind that is that our balance sheet has limitations, right? We have resource limitations like any foundation. So how do we go beyond just our ability to make grants and investments and use our convening power, our connecting power, our social capital in ways that can help the space and kind of give us a larger footprint maybe than just our dollars could do alone?
Do you ever find it to be a challenge to separate the family from the family business?
You know, Marty talks about this, my wife, a lot, that we have to make sure that when, you know, the danger in, I think this is in any family business, but particularly the foundation, because we're all so passionate about the work that we do, the danger is that any family dinner becomes an offshoot of a foundation meeting. So we've really tried to kind of define when we're off the clock from the foundation and when that conversation can just go into personal topics and having fun and doing the things that one otherwise would do in a family event.
Let me close with this, Ron. As we mentioned, this world of philanthropy and using capital creatively for social impact has been your second act. What advice would you have for those contemplating or already in the process of their own second act?
So I have a great friend, Mark Friedman, who wrote the book on this concept of encore. This idea that you can have divide your life between a first act and a second act, and that second act can be informed by the work that you did in your first one. So for me, that transition happened at about 45. The age bracket, I've seen folks do their second acts in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. I think the concept is that for me what worked was I did a lot of kind of low-cost trials when I was in my first act. I made some friends like the fellow Jerry Hildebrand that I'd mentioned, who was a great influence in helping me get into social entrepreneurship. We actually got into a few microfinance investments before we even started the foundation, just to understand what the field was. So the idea is you don't necessarily have to jump in all at once. You can start to do what I would kind of call kind of low-cost trials in your first act to kind of decide where you want to be. And the second and final thing is, when I thought I was leaving the world of investing to get into the world of philanthropy, there was a scary prospect of going from one thing to something completely new. And what I found now in talking to dozens of folks that have gone through successful encores is it can often be more of a pivot than a reinvention.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that pivot was taking everything that I'd learned in the world of investing and kind of converting that to this concept of impact investing and investing with purpose. And I've had friends do the same things in fields of technology and healthcare and management and infrastructure and logistics. So if you've developed a career in something that you really enjoy doing, that you're highly capable at, have lots of experience and connections, give some thought to how you can pivot and apply what you're uniquely good at to a problem in the world that you care about that needs your help and attention.
Some very good advice. Well, Ron Cordes, the co-founder of the Cordes Foundation, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. What is your website and what's there that you think listeners might find of interest?
So our website is cordesfoundation.org, and I'd encourage you to check it out. We've got profiles on all of our grantee and investee partners to learn more about some of the organizations we support. We've got profiles of our fellows, 530 of them now, to get a feeling for who are the brightest young social entrepreneurs in the world. And we've got some media up there just talking about impact investing in the space. So we'd love to have you check us out just to learn more about what it is that we're doing and how you might be able to participate.
Well, thanks, Ron. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
My pleasure as well.
And that is this week's show. Next week, my guest will be Gene Case, the president of the Case Foundation and the author of the just-released book, Be Fearless, 5 Principles for a Life of Breakthroughs and Purpose. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and I hope you'll return next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.